Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota is known for its friendly tax structure. Our private trust industry is thriving. But what's at stake when the wealthiest in the world opt out of the taxation process in their own countries? Oliver Bullough is the author of the new book, Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Rule the World and How to Take It Back. He's in town for a lecture at Augustana University, and he joins us in the SDPB Sioux Falls studio to discuss his book and for a look at how South Dakota figures into what some people consider a hidden economy with enormous costs. Oliver, thanks for being with us today.
That's my pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Tell us a little bit when you began this adventure as a journalist and started figuring out that this was a story, that this was 100 stories, that this was, a project that you really wanted to keep following. Take us back to the beginning.
So I'm a sort of Russianist, a former Soviet Unionist. I'd lived in Moscow for a long time and reported on issues in Russia with President Putin and his various foreign adventures and all that. And so a lot of what I was reporting on were things like human rights abuses, war, general corruption, collapse of state infrastructure. It was pretty depressing, to be honest. It's a great place to live, but it's a depressing stories that you end up working on. And then I was in Ukraine in 2014 when they had a revolution. There were big protests for months in the center of Kiev, the capital, and they drove out the president. And after he left, he left behind, because he had to leave in a hurry, he left behind his palaces and rooms full of treasures and, you know, actual treasures. I mean, real, very valuable things. And these amazing, insane, vulgar, over-the-top, gold-leaf-encrusted palaces. And I spent a lot of time wandering around these. One of the great things after a revolution is there's not really anyone to tell you you can't do things. So if you look sufficiently confident in what you're doing, then you can get away with almost anything. So I used to explore all these hidden, you know, luxury residences of the fallen elite. And it was while doing that that a local friend there, Anton, who was a revolutionary, pointed out to me that the way that all of these properties were not owned by Ukrainian individuals or Ukrainian companies, but were all owned by British companies. So they had essentially pretended to be kind of British investors in Ukraine while actually being thieves who had stolen loads of money from their own people and stashed it in these kind of palaces. And so I started looking into why it was that British companies were used to disguise their identity. And then it became the sort of key that unlocked a door into this whole hidden financial system whereby people who are very wealthy don't live, or certainly their money doesn't live in any one country. It's constantly, everything is international. You have your money hidden behind a company in a tax haven somewhere like the British Virgin Islands or the Marshall Islands or wherever. And then that company owns another company in a different tax haven. And essentially what it adds up to is a system whereby you can steal as much as you like from the country you're running, whether that's Nigeria or Venezuela or wherever. You can steal as much as you like from the country you're running. You can hide it in this sort of offshore system, which I call Moneyland. It's like an extra country for the rich. And then once it's there, no one else knows it's there, and you can spend as much money as you like. So, it's an incredibly well-protected system. It's growing and evolving all the time. It's very dynamic. But the effect is that it's driving social breakdown and misery and despair in some of the most vulnerable countries on earth, you know, places like Nigeria, where, you know, terrorist groups have taken over quite a lot of the country, places like Ukraine, which has really lost control of a lot of the country, you know, places like Afghanistan. I mean, you know, the former US Marine Corps general who ran international forces in Afghanistan, he, when asked what the most serious threat his forces faced, was that the Taliban is an annoyance compared to the threat posed by corruption. And it's that, it's the corruption industry. And it's really beggaring the world. And that's what I chose to write about. And often, sadly, the money that is stolen from these countries ends up either in the UK, where I come from, or in the US. The favorite cities of the rich and unscrupulous are London and New York, you know, with Miami and LA coming close behind.
So the corruption industry, it begins with the corruption because there's theft. How much of it is legally protected through tax structures and, you know, through, you know, just the regular procedures that we've set up to protect people's wealth?
Well, essentially, this system, this Moneyland system, this corruption industry, you know, which I suppose you might call it sort of corruption services provision, if you're being ironic, it's making use of structures that were created by wealthy people starting off in Europe and the US and then more broadly to preserve their wealth from taxation. So they created these opaque structures in offshore jurisdictions, you know, the Bahamas obviously is well known to US listeners, but in Europe, places like Monaco, Switzerland, Jersey, you know, often quite small jurisdictions that specialized in protecting the wealth of wealthy people. So they began this whole process in order to avoid taxes. But once these structures were created, enterprising lawyers and accountants realized that you didn't just need to offer them to, you know, honest businessmen who didn't like taxes. You could also offer them to crooks and thieves and kleptocrats, you know, that the same sort of privacy, secrecy, confidentiality, it's, you know, whatever, however, you know, that word, that so opacity which is provided by these structures is as in demand for crooks and thieves as it is for tax dodgers. And that was the realization that caused the problem, really. So people like Vladimir Putin, you know, his family, other oligarchs from Russia, you know, if they want to move money to the US to buy property here or to undermine elections here or whatever, it's very easy. You know, all these structures are out there, they exist, and they exist precisely for that purpose.
How hard is it? You know, tell me what this looks like in real life. You know, you're wandering through a building, you're seeing things, or you're just walking down a street in London or New York, and you look at a building and you say, who owns it? And how hard is it to find the trail of where some of this money is coming from and where it resides?
It's incredibly hard. We run, with some friends, we run a tours in London called the Kleptocracy Tours, when we put people in a bus and we drive around, particularly West London, which is kind of the most posh district in the city, the most high-end district. And we point out the buildings, you know, that belongs to the Russian deputy prime minister. That belongs to a Nigerian regional governor. That belongs to the former president of Egypt. That belongs to the former ruling family of Libya. You know, that belongs, so on and so on. I mean, you can do this, but we're aware that we're only looking at the tip of the iceberg, you know, because right. Most of these properties, whether that be in New York or Florida or wherever, most of them are hidden behind, you know, LLCs or the foreign equivalents of LLCs, which hide their ownership very successfully. I mean, I have a friend who, well, she's now ex-FBI, but former FBI until recently. And she told me that even for her, finding out who owns these companies is almost impossible. You know, you need a leak, really. So as a journalist, you hope to find a leak. You hope to find some form of information from an insider who's maybe doesn't like what's going on, prepared to tell you what's happening. That's what you hold out for. But we're aware that we're describing an absolute fraction of a much bigger problem. You know, the it's something I often think about in terms of the concern over Russian money. You know, I'm a Russianist. I like writing about Russia, but you know, the amount of money coming out of China is vastly greater than the amount coming out of Russia. But we never hear about it because, you know, the Chinese, you know, are very, very good at hiding that money because, you know, if you're corrupt in Russia, they probably make you a government minister. You know, whereas if you're corrupt in China, you probably get killed. So they have to be good at hiding their money. Hmm. So it's a real problem. There is a massive amount of dark matter out there, dark money, which we can see it's somewhere because you can see the effect it has on international statistics. We know it's there. We know it exists, but we don't know where it is.
Where do we see the impact of it? Is it in spending? Is it in what's left behind when the money isn't in Nigeria or an economy collapses? Tell me some of the places where you can really see it at work.
Well, I mean, it's visible in two places. It's visible in the place it comes from and the place where it's spent. So I mean, I did a lot of work in Ukraine after the revolution, looking into healthcare. Healthcare had been looted. You know, insiders in the health ministry had been stealing, you know, a huge amount of money. Ukraine has a constitutional right to healthcare, so Medicare for all type situation, nominally. But actually, in reality, all that money was being stolen. So you had to bribe doctors, you had to bribe nurses, you had to bribe everyone just to get any kind of access to a hospital. You know, and meanwhile, medicines were much more expensive than they should be because insiders were inflating the prices to cream money off. Often the medicines that were being sold were in doses that were too small to do any good because they'd been creaming more money off. Any opportunity to steal money, they'd been stealing that money. So, you know, the effect on the health of Ukraine was catastrophic. This place had very low life expectancy, very high rates of death from preventable diseases, you know, cardiovascular conditions, things like that. Very rapidly increasing rates of HIV infection, tuberculosis, you know, diseases that we thought that, you know, were conquered, polio, things like this, mm-hmm. diseases that we don't hear about anymore. They were coming back. It was a real, you know, serious problem. So all this money is being stolen from Ukraine via places like Cyprus and a lot of it ending up in places like London. And in London, meanwhile, that money is inflating property prices in parts of London and in other bits of the country so that no British people could afford to live in whole chunks of their own country. So you have this essentially doubly unfortunate situation where money is being stolen from a situation where people really need it. You know, people are dying of eminently preventable causes because this money is being stolen and it's being spent somewhere which is preventing people from having something they also need, which is houses, because, you know, it's a really, I mean, unless you're actually the person doing the stealing, there's nothing to be said for this system at all.
Is it getting bigger? Is Moneyland expanding, and at how fast a rate?
It is getting bigger. The amount of money that is being stolen is increasing all the time. It's difficult to put precise figures on this because the guardians of Moneyland, the enablers of Moneyland, the lawyers and accountants who help this to happen are very clever, and they're always coming up with new tools. There is a research organization in Washington, D.C. called Global Financial Integrity, and they've looked at trade statistics and international financial flows, and they estimate that the amount of money being stolen each year from the world's poorest countries and stashed in places like this, in the UK and Switzerland and so on, is just over $1 trillion a year. So they say 1.1 trillion. That was their most recent estimate. I find it personally difficult to distinguish between like trillion, billion, million. You know, they're all big numbers, I know, but the difference between them, just to put that in perspective, how much $1 trillion is. If you had $1 million in dollar bills and you settled down to count them one a second till you were done, that would take you about 11 days. If you had $1 billion, that would take you about just over 31 years. If you had $1 trillion, that would take you 31,000 years. So, you know, the first humans to arrive in North America had started counting and didn't stop. They'd be about halfway. It's a lot of money. And that much is being stolen every year from places like Nigeria, places like China, places like Ukraine, Russia, Afghanistan. And it's ending up, you know, inflating property prices in Manhattan, so Manhattanites can't afford to live there anymore. So it's nothing to be said for it, really.
So take me to Manhattan, take me to the United States, and let's land in South Dakota and talk a little bit about our trust industry here, because we've intentionally set up a trust statute that opens the door for people to, you know, I think there's more than 90 trusts in the state, a couple billion dollars flowing through there. How does the Moneyland sort of flow through South Dakota? Well, or does it?
Well, Moneyland is a perpetually dynamic concept. It isn't tied to any one jurisdiction. If one jurisdiction becomes more welcoming or less welcoming, the money will flow away or flow back. It's constantly moving all the time. So it used to be, you know, 40, 30, 10 years ago, that the most sort of attractive places to put your money were the places you'd think of: Switzerland, you know, the Bahamas, you know, the offshore places. Either they had mountains or they had, you know, palm trees, you know, the stereotypical tax havens. But after the global financial crisis, there was a big push by the major Western economies to stop this happening. They were fed up with losing tax revenues and so on. And so there was a big push to open up these tax havens. And it was very successful. Places like Switzerland were forced to admit who owns their bank accounts in a way that they never had before. Places like the Bahamas and so on had to do so too. But that didn't stop the demand from wealthy people to hide their money and avoid paying taxes. It just meant that they needed to find somewhere else to do it. And one of the great beneficiaries of that has been South Dakota. The South Dakota trust industry has increased in size over the last 8 years. From approximately $50 billion being held in trust here to almost $300 billion. It's an increase in size of more than 400% in 8 years. And a lot of that money, not all of it by any stretch of the imagination, a lot of it is still US money, but a lot of that money is foreign-owned money, which is being moved here to take advantage of the fact that although foreign countries exchange information with the United States doesn't exchange information with foreign countries. Essentially, there's a one-way flow of information which was created by the US to prevent US citizens being able to dodge taxes. But now it's being used, ironically, by citizens of foreign countries to dodge taxes by putting their money in the US. And South Dakota has benefited from that. Well, certainly South Dakota trust companies have benefited from that. But I don't want to be unfair to South Dakota, which I've only been here for a couple of days, but I'm loving it here. It's a gorgeous state, and the weather is, I understand, always like this, and which is nice. But it isn't only South Dakota. Nevada has also benefited from this. Wyoming is trying very hard. Delaware is traditionally a big financial center and is doing very well. Alaska is having a go. So there are a number of U.S. states that are taking advantage of this. Essentially, it's like a loophole, a very big loophole in the way that information is exchanged globally to attract money from overseas. Just at the end of last year, four Chinese businessmen or business people with a net worth of $17 billion all moved their money into trust here in the US because they wanted to avoid it being declared to the Chinese government. You know, so it's a lot of money. It's coming all the time. You know, and I mean, it provides jobs here. You can see why the system is attractive for South Dakota.
Is that the main attraction for a state like South Dakota? Is the you know, 500 or so jobs? Or is there some kind of other financial benefit? Because it doesn't seem like it's a huge industry at this point.
I mean, it's about the jobs. I mean, you know, South Dakota doesn't have an income tax. So there isn't that. But it's, you know, 500 people earning good, you know, 100K salaries. You know, it adds up, right? I mean, that's a lot of people going to, you know, buy food, a lot of people buying houses. You know, it's money into the economy. This basis being an international financial services center, the basis of an economy, it served other places very well for a long time. Switzerland has done well out of it, obviously. Places like the island of Jersey in the English Channel, in the Caribbean, the Bahamas, Bermuda, the British Virgin Islands, these have all done very well from the same calculation. You know, the money doesn't hang around. The money just passes through. But in passing through, it employs lawyers, accountants, administrators who do well out of it. So that's the calculation. And currently, it's South Dakota's turn to benefit from this.
Tell me about the transparency. When, you know, how do we know whose money is here and where it came from? What are some of the regulations or the openness or lack thereof about what exactly we're dealing with in a trust industry in the state?
Well, the U.S. is a real outlier in this regard, particularly in Europe. But more globally, to a certain extent as well, there's a real push towards transparency. The Europeans are beginning to publish information about who owns all companies, the actual owner of companies. This is happening as well in the British overseas territories, the traditional tax havens. They're beginning to collect information. It won't be published publicly, but it will be published to government about who the beneficiaries are of trusts and so on. So there is a real movement towards financial transparency. In the EU, the calculation being that inequality is bad, inequality is increasing, and that if you are able to hide your property, you are less likely to voluntarily pay taxes. I mean, who after all voluntarily pays taxes? In the US, that isn't happening. The US is still much more opaque in terms of ownership than European countries. So there was recently a great piece of research by Global Financial Integrity, actually, who calculate the amount of money flowing out of poor countries each year, in which they went from state to state and assessed how easy it was to get a library card compared to how easy it is to create a company. The good news is it's quite difficult to get a library card. The bad news is it's very easy to set up a company. You know, and obviously there are benefits to it being easy, but also there are very significant downsides. You know, the government's audit office has published some really alarming misuses of U.S. corporate structures in obviously moving drug money, but also in moving nuclear materials out of the former Soviet Union without being able to say who was behind it. You know, an opaque corporate structure is a very useful tool for a fraudster. It's very hard to be a really successful fraudster without one. So it is alarming, looked at from an EU perspective, that though the EU is moving ahead on this, that the US has decided not to. It's not to say there isn't pressure in this country for this to happen, but it isn't on the horizon anytime soon.
So right now, I guess I want to be fair to the trust attorneys in South Dakota, and because we don't want to make an unfair connection between.
Oh no!
No, they're not openly saying this money has been stolen from the healthcare industry in Ukraine. Let's hide it in South Dakota. So let's be real.
Oh no! Okay,
I'm trying to get at that question.
I'm talking about two different issues here. There is a trust industry, and there are in other states, not so much in South Dakota. There is an incorporation industry.
Right.
So some states have been very, very open to allowing just anyone to incorporate in them, Nevada in particular, and those companies are then misused to commit fraud. That isn't what I'm talking about with South Dakota at all. South Dakota is about a trust industry, which is essentially shielding wealth from tax and from scrutiny. And there are perfectly legitimate reasons why people would want to do that. If you are a wealthy Colombian, for example, or a wealthy Chinese businessman, there are very good reasons why you don't want your government to know how much money you've got. I'm not, you know, that's not to say that it is always illegitimate, but it can be illegitimate. There are also people who have large amounts of money and don't want their governments to know about it because that money is illegitimately earned. And I think what, as a world, we have been very bad at, and this is not a South Dakota specific point.
Right.
This is you could say the UK has been very bad at this. The US in general has been bad at this. All of Europe has been bad at this. For the longest time, we've been very bad at dividing a line between legitimate and illegitimate wealth. We've allowed them to mingle together and to use the same structures and to hide in the same ways. So,
because we don't know or because we don't want to know?
I think, to be honest, it is very difficult to reveal who owns illegitimate wealth without also revealing who owns legitimate wealth. And the owners of legitimate wealth don't really want that information to be revealed. So I think at the moment, sadly, the crooks and the thieves, the Vladimir Putins of this world, are able to hide behind the legitimate concerns of a businessman from Colombia, for example, who doesn't want their wealth declared. And Putin and other people of his nature are able to take advantage of that, of the structures that have been created to benefit legitimate businessmen and women. And the trouble is to try and find a way to separate those two out. I don't think it's impossible, but it's proving difficult.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Oliver Bolo. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. His new book is released in the United States on May 7th. It's called Moneyland, the Inside Story of the Crooks and Kleptocrats Who Rule the World. For South Dakota listeners, define kleptocrat.
Kleptocrat is a word, it's quite an old word actually, but it gained its modern usage in the 1960s. It's from the same sort of Greek term as democrat or autocrat, or it, you know, krat means rule, government by that. I mean, power, and klepto, theft. So kleptocrat is democrat is government of the people, the demos. Autocrat is government by oneself, and kleptocrat is government by thieves. But kleptocracy means more than just government by thieves. There is essentially a global system of stealing. It's not just stealing and not just, you know, being a thief and stealing a little bit. It's about stealing a lot, stashing it overseas, and then essentially using your position of power to dominate the country and enrich yourself. The guy who created the modern use of the term kleptocrat, this guy called Stanislav Andreski, a Polish sociologist, he called it government by thieves, of thieves, and for thieves. And I think that's a nice way of putting it. It's classic kleptocracies, like really obvious ones, would be places like Russia, places like Venezuela, places like Afghanistan, places where the government has become so corrupted that it's essentially, there is no part of the state that's been left untouched. There is no honest core in the state in which you can to build from. And it's very, very hard to recover from that once you've gone that far. You know, people often will refer to sort of Western politicians as, oh, he's a kleptocrat. They're not. If there is a bit of the state which has not been corrupted, you're not talking about a kleptocracy. You're just talking about a nasty person. You know, a kleptocracy is much, much greater than that. It's when the prosecutor's office is used to punish your business enemies, not to investigate crime. It's when the police is used to as a protection racket. It's when, you know, the health ministry is a theft mechanism, not something that provides health. That's what a kleptocracy is. It's when every part of the government is corrupted, and there is essentially corruption ceases to be a useful word because, you know, everything's gone. You know, that's what a kleptocracy is.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Oliver Bolo after the break. Stay with us on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. My guest today is journalist Oliver Bolo. His new book is released in the U.S. on May 7th. It's called Moneyland, the Inside Story of the Crooks and Kleptocrats Who Rule the World. He came to South Dakota to have a lecture and time with students at Augustana University. Anything else that you're doing while you're here, Oliver?
I'm also going to be working on an article about the South Dakota trust industry. Any trust lawyers listening, give us a shout. I'm very keen to talk to as many people as I can. I'm interested in you know, what it means for the state, where it came from, and all that. I think it's a super interesting phenomenon, which I don't think has really been explored in terms of what it means long term. I mean, the South Dakota's sort of special advantage, and sort of secret sauce, as it were, is that the trusts here last forever. They're called dynasty trusts, perpetual trusts. Whereas in most traditional common law jurisdictions, they run out after about 100 years.
Did that change? It's fairly recent.
1983, okay, I think, yeah. Or 84 possibly, when Governor Janklow was in charge. And it was around the time that they brought in the credit card companies came in to Sioux Falls and so on. I don't actually know why he changed the law. Anyone knows? Could they call in?
Because he was Governor Janklow. He had an idea, in growing the economy and trying to figure out...
Someone must have suggested to him that abolishing the law against perpetuities was a good idea, and I'm interested to know who that person was.
Send us an email inthemoment@sdpb.org. We'll watch our emails now, and if anyone has the history of that.
I mean, so please do. Please let us know. But the consequence of that was that if you put assets in trust here, as opposed to other states, then they will remain in trust. And because if normally when a trust ends, the assets emerge from the trust and they're taxed. Here, that will no longer be the case. They won't emerge from the trust. They will essentially stay in the trust until they're spent, this only happened, in the 1980s. We don't really know what this is going to mean.
In South Dakota, the conversation is often really about agriculture. And so you're really talking about farmers who are trying to keep the farm in the family for generations. So a lot of I'm not saying that is the motivation behind the statute, but a lot of our conversations people are going to immediately think, well, if I have land in South Dakota and I'm a farmer, I want to make sure in perpetuity that is, within my family and we're stewards of that land.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a totally, that's fine, right? I mean, I'm a farmer's son myself. I think that's a great idea. My brother might have a bit of a squabble about who exactly it was ended up with the farm, but it's more about when someone puts billions of dollars in trust and that remains in trust, and then their children will then have asset, will receive the benefit of that money, and then their children and the grandchildren and the great grandchildren and the great grandchildren and the great great grandchildren, until all the money is spent. But if you're talking billions of dollars, then those billions of dollars will be earning an income. With the best will in the world, you're going to struggle to spend that money. Even if you really try, it's hard to spend a lot of money. Not that I've tried, but apparently, and so
as evidenced by some of the strange things people spend a lot of money on.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, even if you start buying yachts and stuff, you're going to struggle to drop more than a couple of $100 million on a yacht. And if you've got billions to spend, I mean, how many yachts can anyone buy? So it's difficult. My heart goes out to them. So the interesting point is what happens in say 200, 300, 400 years we're not just talking about a couple of children arguing about who owns a farm, but thousands of people who are all very distant cousins, the sixth, seventh, eighth cousins who don't know each other. If they have a meeting, they have to hire a football stadium to have a meeting. And then, because of genealogists have worked back, to look back in time, you can see how distant people can be from each other and still be cousins. Barack Obama and George W. Bush are cousins, weirdly, as are Barack Obama and Winston Churchill were cousins. I mean, I don't believe they knew each other. I believe that Winston Churchill died before Barack Obama was born. But still, the point stands that you can have the most improbable people would theoretically be beneficiaries of the same trust. And this causes all sorts of potential consequences in terms of sort of social relations and all that, which I don't think has been discussed. And then another point is we had a broadly equivalent system in the UK a long time ago. The reason why you can't put assets in trust forever in the UK was that in the Middle Ages, people kept giving property to the church. But once you gave property to the church, it stayed with the church and the church never gave it back. So an increasingly large amount of the country belonged to the church, which meant that the church became extraordinarily powerful and started kind of dominating everything, which had all sorts of consequences, which led to great upheaval and civil war and all that. And no one wants that. So I think essentially walling off quite a lot of the economy and putting it in trust and saying this will never be taxed and this will never there'll be no churn in this property. This will just stay where it is. I don't think this is a phenomenon that has received the kind of attention it deserves, because that is a major change in the very underpinning of how society works.
This is an economic question. Is it also a moral question?
Well, I think it's an everything question, actually, because it goes, it's legal, it's moral, it's political, it's you're essentially creating an aristocracy, right? You know, we have aristocrats in Britain still. Some of the richest people in Britain are people whose ancestor came over from France 1,000 years ago and stole a bit of land, and now that's London. And, you know, they're really rich. That's what we do in Britain. We have a royal family. But you're America, right? You know, your whole point is that you don't have that. You're supposed to be, you're the land of the free and the land of opportunity, and you get off the boat and everyone has a fair chance. And then, you know, I think you need to be, if you're getting rid of that, you should be having a debate about it at least. You know, it's, aristocrats aren't, you know, they're very decorous and they look great in the red robes and things, but I'd got to say, from speaking as a Brit, I think you're better off without them.
EB-5 visas. Let's talk about how that intersects with this before we let you go.
EB-5 visas are, I don't understand why they're not discussed more. There is it's a phenomenon in the world which was actually invented by the Canadians, but the US and the UK got on the bandwagon quite quickly, which was that you sold residency to wealthy foreigners. Initially, the idea was to try and attract people from Hong Kong when Hong Kong was going to be handed back to communist China. It was widely believed that there would be a big influx of wealthy Hong Kong Chinese people who desperately want to get out, and we wanted them to come to our country so they'd bring their money with them. And, you know, that's now gone. Hong Kong is Chinese, and that's all. We've moved on. But this has persisted as a system. And every year, the US sells 10,000 visas to overwhelmingly Chinese people who come here and create new lives. It's a very strange, scandalous, odd industry. You know, because it was created in the 80s, it hasn't really been changed yet. It's a paper-based industry. So, you know, if I apply for a visa, you know, it's an online process, right? I go to the embassy and I, you know, type in all the information, and then that zips through various databases. And, you know, the FBI, are they interested? You know, I don't know, the CIA, for all I know, are they interested? And so everyone, you know, it's all automated. But not with the EB-5 program. That's done on paper. So you've got, you know, Chinese people with a lot of money, and getting information about the origin of Chinese people's wealth is hard. Applying for visas on paper, so none of it's automated. And no one really knows where this money came from or what these people want or anything. It's a very strange system. And leaving aside the scandalous consequences that you have at this end, whereby you have politically connected people, you know, bringing this money in to do particular property developments, it's very odd. I mean, but I don't want to single out the US for criticism here. You know, the Canadian program was so bad they cancelled it. The UK one has been dreadful. And then that's leaving aside countries that don't just sell visas, they sell passports. So, you know, if you put enough money in Malta, they just give you a passport. Cyprus does the same. Lots of countries in the Caribbean now do that. It's a growing industry that if you're wealthy, you can buy citizenship, buy a visa. You get to opt out of your own country, and instead you're a citizen of Grenada or St. Kitts and Nevis, Malta. And then you get to swan around the world and not really be a citizen of anywhere, which is what I call a citizen of Moneyland.
From the book Moneyland, you also talk about taking it back. Give us one direction, one conversation that we should be having about this going forward before we let you go.
Well, one thing in the US you're really good at is enforcement, enforcing corruption legislation. The US was a pioneer in having an extraterritorial bribery act, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which was, you know, has been one of the great tools for fighting corruption around the world, and you know, long may it continue. It's an absolutely amazing thing, and it's been a force for good in many, many countries. That example the US has set has sadly not been followed by other countries. In Europe, though, we're much better on, say, transparency. When it comes to enforcement, we are dire, you know, way, way down the bottom of the division. So, you know, enforcement is amazing. The US has been good at that. But the thing that I would say we're better at in Europe is knowing who owns things. It's really important to know who owns things. And I'm not talking about, you know, being prurient and looking through your neighbor's underwear drawer. It's about saying if someone's come from Russia and they've got $5 billion, how do they get those $5 billion? Because you don't earn $5 billion in Russia without cutting some corners. We need to know what they own, because, you know, a foreign billionaire doesn't stop being a corrupt crook just because they've got off a plane at JFK or Heathrow Airport. They're still a corrupt crook. They just happen to be a corrupt crook in our country rather than their own. And they will corrupt our system as they've corrupted their own system. So to my mind, this is a question of national security. We've seen what the you know, what the destabilizing effect can be of a bit of concern about foreign money in the US electoral process, you know, over the last couple of years. You know, we're seeing similar echoes of that, not as extreme, but echoes of that in the UK with possible foreign involvement in the Brexit process. You know, I'm not saying either of those things was a decisive factor, but it's been a destabilizing factor, just the discussion of it. And a lot of that discussion has been about the fact that we don't know. You know, it's impossible to say where this money came from, what it was doing, how much of it there was. And the reason we don't know is because they're able to take advantage of opaque financial structures in places like Nevada or Delaware. You know, and that is a concern. And I think that, you know, we are going to have to overcome the reluctance of the wealthy and powerful in our own countries to have, you know, the identity of or the information about their assets shared, if only with the government, because we need to do that in order to keep ourselves safe from foreigners who really wish us ill.
Oliver Bullough, thank you so much for
thank
being
you.
Here. We really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
Welcome to South Dakota. Come back.
I will, and the weather will stay like this forever.
Absolutely, we promise. The book is called Moneyland, The Inside Story of the Crooks and Kleptocrats Who Rule the World. It's released in the U.S. May 7th.